Testing, testing. Business, Housing, and Finance, February 10th, Work Session 201, 202, Public Hearing 145, 146, 147, 148.
The first thing I'd like to do is bring to the members' attention that we have introduced, that staff has prepared a list of committee bills that came, that were delivered to your offices. We intend at the next meeting to introduce those and other committee bills that that may come forth from the members, but I'd like for you to look at the list and on our next meeting on Thursday be prepared to for the introduction of those as committee bills. What I'd like to do now is to go into a work session on Senate Bills 201 and 202. And, Mr. Rogers, you can come forth in case we need you. You've already given us good testimony already, and but in case we need you, and what I'd like to do now is, Bob, would you please give us a summary of Senate Bills 201 and 202?
Yes, through Senator to the committee, Senate Bill 201 amends ORS 472.113 that had authorized additional licenses, Class C dispenser licenses for restaurants that serve food and do not have taverns or lounges on the premises. The commission has just about granted their allotment of those licenses, and as a result of the increase in tourism in Oregon and additional restaurants opening up that would like to serve distilled spirits to their patrons, their commission is requesting that an additional allotment of licenses, Class C licenses, become available, and Senate Bill 201 speaks to that need. Senate Bill 202 generally deals with some housekeeping measures of the commission. They have two new privileged tax license, wine warehouse and brewery public houses, and they both require surety bonds, and minimum bond requirements are listed in 471.290 subsection 5. And they feel that for purposes of consistency with the statutory scheme, they should be included with the bonds that are needed for other licenses under ORS 471.210 subsections 1 and 2. In addition to that, they would like to extend Hyde House exceptions to seasonal dispensers and dispenser Class C and tour boat licenses that were not included when the statutory measures were enacted in a previous session. In addition to that, they want to grant 90-day temporary licenses for changes in ownerships to allow for the continuation of a business enterprise while they process the licensing applications. And finally, there's a provision in Senate Bill 202 that would allow salesmen to begin work immediately with a temporary license granted while the commission processes the applications through police checks and so forth. And what this basically does is allow for the people to begin work pursuant to a disposition from the commission on the license application, and reduces the burden on small business persons.
Yes. Mr. Rogers, anything like that you'd like to add?
No, I think that pretty well covers it. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yes.
I move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is that that's both Senator Simmons or?
201 and 202, if you can take them both at once.
Thank you very much, Senator Simmons. Any discussion? Clerk call roll.
Senator Fry?
Aye.
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 Aye. See, the carrier for Senate Bill 201 will be Senator Kinnemer. And Senate Bill 202 Senator Simmons. Heir of Senate Bill 202 will be Senator Simmons. All right, now we'll move into hearing, please. Thank you very
much, Chairman.
Yes. First bill up for hearing will be Senate Bill 145. And our witness for that will be Mr. Bill Brooks from the Corporation Division. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I am Bill Brooks, a senior securities examiner with the Corporation Division. Mrs. Edwards, the Corporation Commissioner, is unable to be here because I believe she's at Ways and Means. Let me first describe the problems addressed by this bill, and then I'll talk about how the bill addresses those problems. The problems are boiler rooms, which operate out of California, Florida, Los Angeles, and any other high-life places where the sun shines. Con men spend hours dialing unsuspecting victims, including Oregon residents, either with long-distance cold calls or leads furnished by responses to ads in local and national newspapers. What is their pitch? They're selling gold or some other precious metal or commodity, usually an item that the public knows from the media that the price is going up on. I would refer you to Exhibit A to this testimony, which provides you an example of the kind of advertisement that the people call in on. As you can see, Bannister and Brighton, they usually always pick a quality sounding name, is offering gold, silver, and platinum. What would a typical presentation be? The con man would tell the prospective investor that for as little as $1,500, he can control $10,000 worth of gold. Thus, for every $10 an ounce that the price of gold goes up, he makes $230. This occurs, if it occurs in 1 month, it translates into a 180% return on his investment. That's pretty nice. The con man will also tell the prospect that he has inside information that the price is about to shoot up, so he'd better hurry. He's even prepared to send a messenger to collect the money. The investor's led to believe that he's purchasing X number of dollars worth of gold for a 15% down payment. The balance is going to be payable over a long period of time, and interest, while payable, will probably never become due because he'll be able to sell out shortly and make huge profit. He's told that the gold is stored in some special facility that the firm has developed deep in the earth in Nevada or in a special vault or whatever plays. The average investor might send in $5,000 to $10,000. Some send much more. What is the catch? The firm has no gold. The investor's fortunes don't rest on the rise of the price of gold. His money's simply gone. The con man has taken it. These guys are experts at stringing the investor along. As long as the price is rising, they have a little difficulty. If it starts to fall, the investor might get a fresh tip and roll his over into some other hot commodity. The string along continues until the complaints start and publicity ensues. Then the con men simply pick up and move to another location and start over again. In the meantime, they've taken thousands of dollars. In 1984 testimony at congressional hearings, commodity and investment fraud schemes losses were estimated to be around $200 million. We think they've grown substantially since. There are two current regulatory efforts. One is federal and one is state. The federal effort, Congress passed the Commodities and Exchange Act and created an enforcement agency, which is the Commodities Futures and Trading Commission. In 1948, Congress also created, under the guidance of the CFTC, the National Futures Association, which is a self-regulatory organization, something like the National Association of Securities Dealers, which related to the securities industry. The CFTC requires all futures trading to be conducted on approved exchanges, such as the Chicago Board of Trade or the Chicago Mercantile, those that you've heard of. The CFTC primarily regulates the transactions on those legitimate exchanges. Legitimate trading has historically developed for a very needful economic purpose being to establish prices for farmers for their products such as pork bellies, cotton, wheat, soybeans, and so forth. That is commodities, or that is purchase of specific commodities to be delivered in the future. The crooks claim they're outside the federal law because they're not selling futures contracts. The CFTC does have a couple of people in Los Angeles to protect the West Coast. While we get some help from them, they don't touch the total problem. The CFT is trying without success to get the media to stop running these ads, which would be very helpful. And a recent article in the Statesman is attached as Exhibit B to indicate that effort. The Corporation Division, the state regulatory effort, has been trying to deal with these frauds under securities laws, but it's difficult to prove that the purchasers are making investments as opposed to purchasing commodities. The evidence that we need is located in the state where the boiler room is operating. It's not readily available to us. This bill, Senate Bill 145, attacks the problem head on. It says very simply, no delivery, you've got an illegal contract. The bill comes from a model commodity code developed by the North American Securities Administrators Association. It's been adopted in Missouri, New Mexico, and very recently in the state of Washington. It's pending in several other states. The Senate bill has the support of the CFTC and the NFA, except for a few minor amendments that I learned about yesterday that I'll talk about later. In summary, the code makes it illegal to sell commodities unless they are excluded or are exempt from the ban. The exemptions are 1, commodity contracts lawfully sold under the Commodities and Exchange Act, 2, contracts sold by persons registered with the CFTC, 3, contracts between producers and consumers or end users of the commodity, that is the commercial contract, and 4, contracts providing for actual delivery of the commodity to the purchaser within 28 days or in the case of precious metals, if they are delivered to an approved depository, they are likewise exempt. And 5, contracts where the purchaser is a financial institution or an insurance company. In addition to those gut provisions, the bill adopts from the Oregon securities laws parallel provisions for the administrative, civil injunctive, and criminal sanctions. This bill will give the corporation and division an arrow in its quiver. We will be able to advise Oregon residents that these contracts are illegal. We will be able to issue cease and desist orders quickly and publicize these orders. We may even be able to persuade newspapers and other media from running the ads in the first instance. In addition to this testimony, I provided a section-by-section analysis that I could review, or if you have any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Simmons.
I don't see anything in here making it illegal to sell the Marion Street Bridge.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, Marion Street Bridge perhaps would be construed as real property, and there is a specific exclusion for the Marion Street Bridge. I suspect that if it's real property, I suspect that that doesn't answer the question that you're driving at. Perhaps if we use another example.
Well, the question I'm driving at is, if these boiler rooms are out of state, what real control do we have over their operating here by telephone?
We have little control over it, Senator Simmons, because of the reason that you suggest. That's why we believe that with this bill, probably the most we'll be able to do is to issue some cease and desist orders on some fairly minimal information.
Well, against whom?
Against the caller, the company.
Brighton and whatever against, that doesn't exist?
Yes, Senator, and we believe that if we publicize that cease and desist order, it'll be another assist to the public in making them aware. We believe that if we get a call then from an investor who wants to invest in Brighton, When the ad first appears, that we'll be able to indicate to them that those contracts are illegal.
Well, as soon as you go after Bannister and Brighton, why, it probably changes to Smithsonian Institute Limited or something, and it's the same people but a different name. I think the purpose is admirable, but it just occurs to me that it's very, very difficult to protect people against their own foolishness. The pigeon drop or any of these other out-and-out frauds attract gullible people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, we absolutely agree with you. It is difficult. We don't believe that it's going to be a cure-all, end-all. But we believe if we can shoot out these cease and desist orders promptly and quickly, that it is at least going to help. We do have people responding to these ads who are, sometimes are little old ladies and who lose a significant portion of their accrued assets. And we think that if we can at least get some publicity out there, that maybe we're going to save some of those. We're not going to get them all by any means or imaginations, because they do pick up and operate under a new name. There's no question about that. We believe that we will also cooperate under the bill with the CFTC and with the other states as they're coming online with this same kind of bill, and eventually get a criminal prosecution, which is probably the only effective means of putting these people out of business.
And to get a criminal prosecution against somebody in Massachusetts or New York or Pennsylvania or Nevada or wherever, how do you develop evidence? Do you actually send them some money and then find that it isn't? When you've lost the money, you bring a suit? Or,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, we would be inclined in a situation like that where we would find ourselves working with a United States attorney in the appropriate district, and they have all the appropriate powers to subpoena bank records, et cetera, to build a criminal case against those individuals.
Under a federal statute, but not an Oregon law.
That's correct.
Would that come under postal misuse, or are they using Federal Express now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, there. When they bring one of these cases, quite frankly, they don't care whether they bring it under the wire statutes or the securities laws or the commodities laws. It seems like the United States District Attorney determines whether he has facts to inflame and injure a jury, and he picks whatever he thinks at the particular time might be the most appropriate law to put these people away, and then sometimes it's the Internal Revenue Law.
I just wonder, Mr. Chairman, if it wouldn't do more good to utilize the amount of money that it would take to enforce one of these to provide an educational campaign, maybe through our friendly bank, who would send out with their statements a flyer saying, beware of the telephone solicitor that you don't know who's maybe going to take your money away from you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, I think education is certainly admirable, and I believe that the commissioner has educational efforts in mind. On the question of money, we would suggest that this bill will not cost us any money to operate. As a matter of fact, it'll have a beneficial effect. It doesn't cost us any money to operate because we're not establishing any licensing procedures, any red tape, or the division to administer. All it's going to be able to do is make it easier for us to issue the cease and desist order that we're already trying to issue under the securities law. So in effect, it's going to be a more effective way of us doing the same job that we have now, certainly at no additional expense.
Well, I would hope that the cease and desist order really makes somebody cease and desist, but with the ease of telephoning and with the ease of changing a name and with the degree of sophistication that some of these people have, and I've received many of their telephone calls too, they sound rather plausible, particularly when you tell them, do you get any discount if you send 100,000 in instead of five? And then you really get the sales pitch. But I would hope it does.
Senator Frye.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if I'm reading Senator Simmons' questions right, I have to agree that I just am having an awful time understanding why we need this bill. He says it's not going to cost any money. I mean, if the bill's needed and it's going to be successful, we're going to have to find some more room in the penitentiary for these Class B felons that somebody's prosecuting. That's one thing that concerns me a little bit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, with reference to criminal prosecutions, it's not anticipated that we would, in Oregon, be able to effectively pursue a criminal sanction unless, and in fact, this boiler room was not operating out of state, but was in fact operating in state. Presently, under the current situation, they've inclined to operate in these nice places to be. As those states are getting very active and may be pushing some of these operators out of their traditional locations, and they may be coming to Oregon. As a matter of fact, we are presently looking in Portland in an operation that may well be just a boiler room.
Well, all right. I have a number of questions, and one of which is, is there something going on in the state of Oregon that calls for this? I notice you've got an item that apparently it's an AP wire story that was carried in the Statesman Journal, but doesn't have anything to do with Oregon or with the Oregon situation. Then you've got this ad here. I don't know what publication that came out of.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, I'm sorry. I should have indicated that was published in the Oregonian in late fall.
Exhibit A was in the Oregonian?
Yes, sir.
And do you have any reason to think that operation might be illegal if this bill were the law in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, I could say from my online experience that I would, on a scale of 1 to 10, conclude myself personally that there's a 9.99 chance that this is a pure fraudulent boiler room operation.
Well, all right, so that's in your mind now, and I go back to one of Senator Simmons' questions. So you've got somebody down here in California that's running a newspaper ad in the Oregonian. Number one, now there's no argument about the fact that nothing the legislature could do would preclude the Oregonian from running this kind of an ad, right? We can't do that, can we? We can't tell the Oregonian by legislation you can't run these ads, can we?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, I think you're absolutely right. We cannot dictate.
Okay. So we can't tell the Oregonian to knock it off, or the Salem Statesman, or anybody else, that you can't run these ads. So what I want to know is, you've got a 9.99 scale rating here of some wrongdoing on the part of this outfit in California. So now what are you going to do? We give you this law here, so you're sitting here in Salem. Now what are you going to do next?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, one thing I would like to see the division try. We have had excellent cooperation with the Oregonian on classified ads. We haven't been able to have much give and take on these display ads. I think that if we had this law on the books, we would be able to have some conversation with the Oregonian, the Oregonian may well want to ask these people to submit their literature, and it would demonstrate on its face that these are illegal contracts.
Well, the Oregonian can do that right now, can it? If you can make a case for the Oregonian, it seems to me that the Oregonian could do this right now.
Senator Frye, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I don't believe that it's possible to make that determination from the literature that they would get now that would be illegal now, because we don't have anything that focuses on this delivery aspect of it.
Okay, let's leave the newspaper out of the thing. Suppose that you can't, either that you can get somewhere where the air going in, which I suppose you could do now if you could make a case, or you couldn't. So anyway, one way or the other,
I mean, suppose they were going to tell you to go fly a kite. Now what are you going to do about these people in California is what I want to know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, the only thing I think that we can effectively do that we think will be of help will be to quickly issue a cease and desist order as soon as we see this advertisement, get it published in the paper, and give the people the opportunity to know.
Well, now, wait a minute. A cease and desist order, first you've got to get jurisdiction of the party, don't you? You can't just issue a cease and desist order to somebody in California that's never been in an Oregon court.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, I believe section, there is a section in the bill that identifies when offers are made in the state of Oregon. And there's a definition that says a telephone for an offer made from out of state and received by a person in this state is an offer in the state of Oregon, and therefore we would have jurisdiction.
Well, no, wait a minute. Now, this is what I'm having a little difficulty with. Maybe you can say by legislation that a telephone call into Oregon is the kind of conduct that would bring you within the jurisdiction of an Oregon court, but for the act. But what about the individual? How do you get the individual? You think that you can go into the Marion County Circuit Court, for example, and get a cease and desist order against Bannister Brighton Limited in Orange, California, based on something that they wrote or they put in the Oregonian, or on anything else? You think you can do that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, indeed, under the current securities laws, with identical language identifying when offers are made in the state of Oregon and so forth, which we've borrowed almost verbatim from the securities law and put it in this law, we do it.
All right, but look, it's kind of like mailing a pipe bomb into the state of Oregon. If it goes off and hurts somebody in Oregon under the long-arm statute, you could acquire jurisdiction even though the person who sent the pipe bomb was never in the state of Oregon. But so let's assume that you could get jurisdiction over Bannister and Brighton because of this telephone call. Nonetheless, you still got to get those people into an Oregon court. How are you going to do it? You're going to serve them with a show cause notice of some kind, I assume, in Orange County, California, aren't you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, yes, we will serve them in the state of California. And I believe that the commissioner has inserted into the bill a provision on personal jurisdiction that right, I believe might be what you're indicating.
All right. Now, Senator Simmons indicated that with one of his questions, and I think he was right on, that, why do these people want to bother to hire lawyers and appear in the Oregon court? They can just say, well, we're out of business or we'll stop doing it, or they change their name to something else again. What real-life effect is this bill going to give you, and how will it, in real-life Oregon terms, help the public? Can you give me an example of...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Senator Frey, it probably takes at least 6 months to get one of these operations, these boiler rooms, going. They have a Ponzi aspect to them. They will even on occasion pay off a particularly noisy investor to keep the publicity down. I think for the same reason they would want to contest, or some may decide that it's appropriate because of the particular phase that they're at in their scheme, that they would want to contest it or not want to contest it, depending upon where they were.
All right. Now, is it your suggestion or not that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act would not include this kind of conduct that you're concerned about?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, I believe we've been given to understand that it would indeed not cover it.
Well, all right, Mr. Chairman. I got some other questions, but I don't want to take any more time.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Frey. Senator Kenemer.
Yeah. I wonder, isn't one of the major benefits of this that if you come up with a scheme that appears to be fraudulent, you can attack that much quicker, and you can get publicity out, so that consumers are more, they have that closer tie to the time when it was advertised to the time when it's then discredited publicly, and then has a much more enhancing effect to encourage people not to invest in these kinds of ridiculous schemes.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kimmerer, I would thank you for stating my position.
Can I follow up that question?
Are you done?
Yeah.
Senator Frye.
Is there anything to keep you from doing that right now?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, we believe that the only way that the securities, or excuse me, the corporation division can attack this problem currently is to proceed under securities laws, and we have difficulties in so doing.
Well, but Senator Kenemer's question had to do with speaking out, educating the public, warning the folks out there about this kind of stuff, and it seems to me that you could do that right now without any law, couldn't you? I mean, can't you send out press releases and put notices in the paper and hand out brochures and so forth that educate the public about these schemes here right now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, we certainly can, and I think that the Commissioner Edwards, to the extent that she has assets available, is indeed doing that.
Thank you. Any more questions, Mr. Brooks?
Through the chair and committee to the witness, I was out for part of your testimony, but I was wondering, is there a dollar figure on what this is going to cost for implementation if this measure is in fact passed?
Yes, sir. I believe the dollar figure would be zero.
Thank you. Any further questions? Mr. Brooks, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There were those amendments that we would like to propose. I don't know where the...
We had a question on this same subject in a Government Operations Elections Committee about the Secretary of State issuing a subpoena or through a specially designated employee was given that power, and I suppose it's a whole question of agency, but wouldn't that have to be specifically authorized?
Well, I would think that it should, and certainly perhaps if we can't find it now, Senator Simmons and the committee would appreciate receiving an answer to that.
Well, which law are we talking about, sir?
Well, we're looking here at Section 15, which is ORS 725, where you have deleted the authority of the either personally or by an examiner or other employee may do so and so. That's
725.310. Section 15 on page 5 of the printed bill.
I guess I'm lost.
All right.
I had, if you want to look at that and get that back to us later, I think that would be fine.
That would be.
But okay. In view of Mr. Long's testimony the other day, can you tell me how much the administrator of the Financial Institutions Division has to do with the procedures here?
The administrator has the power to review all the penalties that I levy.
That's
has the power to dismiss it or bring it down or whatever.
Does he normally review these penalties?
Yes, it automatically goes to him. Well, only did it once. So.
Yeah, but it... Was that just because you wanted some backing, or is that part of his job, do you think?
It is his job in the statutes.
How do his job and your job differ?
I run the program, and he's there as my boss, I guess, and also runs the, manages the internal affairs and budgeting and all that sort of things. He basically leaves me free to do my work in the regulatory area.
Do you do any field work?
Primarily through my staff, my
but
examiners.
Personally, do you do any field work?
I do go out in the field, yes.
Occasionally or?
Very frequently. I do meetings with board of directors and the like in problem cases. closing off examinations or where we have company that's in trouble. I do a lot of one-on-one meeting with the operating officers also.
And there are now, what, two SNLs, state SNLs under your supervision?
There are five state chartered SNLs.
But are all of them operating?
Yes. And I have two out-of-state institutions operating.
And 172 consumer finance?
Yeah, give or take a few. And approximately 31 savings and loans.
31 credit unions?
Strike that, yes.
And the 172, that includes branch offices?
Yes, which we examine individually.
Yeah, but I mean the 172 figure is a total figure, including branches.
Yes. Well, yeah. Each branch is licensed separately.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Gashi, on the front page of your testimony, when you say that Senate Bill 146 is intended to round out and create similar enforcement options, now, the four things that you listed here, power to go to court, administrative powers to issue cease and desist orders, administrative powers, civil penalties, and the last one, power to proceed against individuals, which, do you have all four of these powers for either one of the savings and loans, credit unions, or consumer finance areas now?
I think it's fairly complete in the savings and loan law.
Okay, so you're, all right, so then you are not asking for anything different. Are you asking for any change as far as savings and loans are concerned?
Subject to check, yes.
Subject to, I'm sorry.
I just didn't want to misstate myself.
Sure, all right.
But it's my belief that I have those powers presently, and I'm not seeking to add anything that beyond that, other than under this one section, to make it unlawful to file a false report.
Okay. Now, for credit unions, what about? I'm just trying to find out what
credit unions. I believe have the power only to go after the company, but not individuals.
Okay. Now, I guess the what I
and it's primarily in the consumer finance area that we want to.
Okay, so it's primarily in the consumer finance here. Now, for credit unions, then, I guess, now you want uniformity.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's what you're seeking. And I guess Senator Simmons' concern and my concern as well is we want to regulate but not over-regulate. And I guess I need to know that, say, in the consumer finance area, what again now do you, why do you need to have this? You've gotten along, I guess, without it so far, and except for the sake of uniformity, why do we need to go ahead and extend these?
It is more particularly in the consumer finance area that I want these powers, because basically I can fine a non-licensee $2,500 or $5,000, I think, for operating without a license. I have no other remedies against, I don't believe I have any other remedies against a non-licensed operation. I can't go to court if they say go to hell. For the violation of a rule, I can issue civil penalties. But for the violation of statutes, particular statutes, I can or cannot do various things. And in particular, I cited that one section where I look for remedies because I have that problem all the time, where they don't return paid papers or do not record satisfaction of judgment, do not release a lien, that sort of things that I consider to be impositions on the public that's dealing with the institutions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Simmons.
Aren't those also violations of regulation as well as violation of statute, those things you mentioned?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, it may be a violation of someone else's regulation, but it is not a violation of my regulation. It is a direct violation of my statute.
As I recall from reading your regulations, though, the regulations refer back to the statute in each individual case, and I think they cover all of that.
I beg to differ, Senator. It's my recollection that for that particular section, there is no rule that covers it because it's already directly covered by the statute.
Do you have a copy of the regulation with you?
Yeah. May I approach the session?
Certainly, Mr. Gosch.
Could be wrong.
Well, I... before signing, we're talking about paid papers particularly. Because the law now says.
That's possible. You know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, at one time, though, it was in the regulation and,
yes.
And it could well be covered. Thank you.
Tom, what would be helpful to me is if you could really focus in on the state of the laws that exist now. What you want, and
yep.
Then why, and then justify why you need the changes made in the savings and loan, credit union, and consumer finance area. That would be helpful.
Do I submit that to the committee, sir? Or
yes, please. You can submit it to the committee administrator, Mr. Parker, and then we'll distribute it to committee members. And I think that will help us. Any further, Senator Frye?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just, when he talked about these people that were refusing to file satisfactions of judgment, it rang a bell with me, and I thought we did something in the last session about that. We did. In 18.350, in the last session, we simply said that it's the responsibility of the judgment creditor to file a full satisfaction with the clerk. So that's the requirement, but I don't find any sanction in case the judgment creditor does not do that. Maybe that's the problem. But.
Yes, and you know, having been in private practice, you hate to see that kind of things go on because the person might want to sell a house or that sort of things and have a lien sitting on top of you that you've already paid for. It's just a plain imposition and I want to be able to respond to those things appropriately.
I think that's probably a good reason for that part of the bill. I'm just wondering, even if this bill didn't become law or something else, I'm just wondering whether we shouldn't do something about this section, chapter 18, that says the judgment creditor, thou shalt do this, but if you don't do it, why, so what? Mm-hmm. The committee administrator could make a note to kind of track this thing along here and see if we need some change in 18.36. I don't know how Senator Simmons feels about that, but we did that, as you recall, in the last session, but I didn't realize we didn't have any teeth in it.
Yeah, I think it's also covered in 725 with respect to a Consumer Finance Act licensee.
It just says he should do it, but there's no...
No, I think...
That's right. There's no penalty.
There's no penalty in 725 either.
Other than, closing the place up. And I don't want to close it. I need the income from those guys.
That's pretty serious.
Senator Frye, do you remember? I'm sorry. Was that RS 18?
350.
All right. Any further questions, Mr. Gashi, on Senate Bill 146? Mr. Bronner is testifying on another bill on the House side, and he requested that we perhaps skip over and leave Senate Bill 147 to give him an opportunity to come back. Mr. Gashi, could we move to Senate Bill 148?
Sure. Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, I'm here in support of Senate Bill 148. I've submitted copies of this statement to the committee. Primarily, this is a housekeeping bill. It deals with updating, clarifying, and reconciling savings and loans, credit union, and consumer finance statutes. And basically, again, this is where Louis Littlehales go through our statutes and pick up inconsistencies and language difficulties, and this is the end result of it. I can hit the sections if you like. In sub one, in the credit union section, we have several definitions of capital, and some are not consistent. What we're trying to do is consolidate all the definitions of capital. In section three, this amendment is intended to straighten out 723.014. The power to order the removal of directors is taken out of that section, and it's restated as a standalone section. It's a legislative cleaning up. The amendment to section 723.152.22 clarifies that credit unions can do IRA transactions. The word self-employed in that section would limit transactions to Kehoe plans. It also reconciles this subsection with subsection 6 of 723.152, which allows a credit union to receive savings from members, and our agency had previously interpreted that section, sub 6, to allow IRA transactions. So we just wanted to make those two sections, to reconcile those two sections. In sub 6, we have a standalone section for power to remove officers. Again, in sub 7, we remove the definition of capital from 723.0011. Again, to consolidate the definitions. In sub 8, we replace the words guarantee fund with regular reserve in 723.5121. Under the prior legislation, the guarantee account was the only reserve account required. The 1981 amendments to the Act required a regular reserve as well as a special reserve. And this amendment clarifies that only the regular reserve is intended. On sections 9 and 10, the amendments to 9 and 10 moves the credit union requirements in ORS 708.438.3 to this section, so we can consolidate all the credit union statutes. In the consumer finance area, section 11, 725.145 generally deals with grounds for disapproval of the license. A provision in sub 2 allowing removal of officers is deleted and made a standalone section similar to the credit union. And in section 12, we streamline procedures for denial of a license. Section 13, this amendment streamlines 725.220, which deals with changing the location of a licensee. Section 14, we point out that there are two sections that deal with denial of a license. And I went to the Attorney General to try to find out which I had to comply with. In one section, I stamped denied if I turned down an application. In another section, it says if I intend to deny it, I have to give notice and write to hearing of intent to deny.
So I said to the Attorney General, which one do I follow? And they said, do both. I said, so I stamped denied on it, and I said, I intend to deny it. So they got a right to two hearings under separate sections, and we're just trying to make sure that we don't have to do twice the same things. In section 17, we delete the section which deals with what the Attorney General must do and what the District Attorney must do when we tender a notice of defalcation. We think that there's enough authorities in those persons in their own separate sections where they can deal with those, and that it's redundant to our statute.
Senator Frey.
Yes, I would agree with what you said. My only question is in the new language there, where the licensee is to notify you of any defalcation within 5 days after discovery. I'm wondering why you would put 5 days instead of just saying promptly.
I can't answer the question. I don't know.
Wouldn't you, just by instinct, wouldn't you feel as a supervisor that you should know about a defalcation as soon as it's been discovered?
I would want to know about it right away, sir.
Just wondering if the 5 days isn't just unnecessarily.
I'd have to talk to the
long leeway there.
I'd have to talk to the drafter of the legislation, unless it was to keep all the notice requirements consistent.
Okay. Yeah, for Senator Kimmerer's benefit, the Mr. Littlehales, who is apparently the one that prepared this bill, was the counsel for the Interim Committee on Banking and Public Finance, who did most of the work on the revisions in the banking code that the legislature adopted in the 85th session. And I've got substantial faith in his ability, the drafter, and so there's probably some reason for the five-day thing. I'm just kind of curious.
I'll find out.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question.
Senator Kenemer.
Yeah. Going into Section 12, I was just noticing that you talked about streamlining it, and I noticed that you changed advise to notify, and then there was no method specified, just notify immediately. Do you not need that it's going to have to be by registered mail? How will you retain a record, and how is that going to be done?
What section is this?
Section 12 on page 5. You notify immediately you're in person?
Yes.
No.
You struck registered mail.
Yeah.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kenemer, I can't answer that. We would have to adopt a consistent method of giving notification, whether it be by registered mail, whatever. And it would be my burden to prove that I, in fact, gave that person notice. So I would take a cautious approach of giving notice when I turn them down.
So then that would be made by Mr. Chairman?
We would ordinarily issue an order anyway, and then we would make formal notification that, you know, we're turning down the application, giving notice of appeal rights and that sort of things. And basically we have adopted the Administrative Procedures Act, so to the extent that is covered, it would be an order, and service of an order, I would assume that we would, well, I would choose to, and I think I'm bound to follow the Administrative Procedures Act to give notice. So I think that it is covered.
Thank you, Senator. Yes. Tom?
Yes.
Would you go ahead and?
Oh. In Section 18, 725.505 requires that we give notice was served notice of rule changes on consumer finance companies. There's no definition of finance, consumer finance companies, so we propose to change it to licensee. So it's clear that I have to notify each outlet, even though it may be the same company operating in 20 places, of the proposed notice of rule change. And in section 20, we're taking out the requirement in 722.158, which requires certain officers only to verify documents. I don't think that's necessary. And the declaration of intent in enacting Chapter 1 ORS laws in 1955 from consumer finance is deleted. And in 725.390 under consumer finance, we repeal that section since the provision moved into 725.385.
Any questions, any further questions from Mr. Higashi on Senate Bill 148?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Simmons.
On page 1, line 10, they struck regular reserve and put in reserves. This applies to credit unions only on this?
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what a reserve is, whether that would include a reserve for bad debts as part of their capital structure.
Well, we're trying to make clear, Senator Simmons, that it does not include bad debt reserve. It's a separate reserve.
But it doesn't say that unless reserve is defined somewhere else. In other words, you've broadened the reserve definition by taking out regular reserve and putting in reserves.
Okay. I think we have different reserves that go into the composition of capital, and this is why we broaden it. But generally, the reserve for bad debt is not included in that.
That would be my understanding from an accounting point of view, but I wonder if broadening the word reserves rather than even calling it a regular reserve
May I respond to that one in writing? I better talk to the experts.
It's a technical question, but when we're making a change, I'd like
Certainly.
To know what's meant by it.
There is a good reason. I can't remember it, however.
Yeah.
Senator Kennemer.
It's interesting. On page 3, then, they insert in line 41, regular reserve, so they go back to that nomenclature. I don't know whether there's a distinction there or not.
Page?
3, line 41.
40. Yeah, they've changed from guarantee fund to regular reserve.
Yeah, again, we're talking about a different thing there.
Mm-hmm.
We could just get some clarification then.
Okay, but in that one, we're talking about 15% of only the regular reserve. And in the other one, we're saying reserves can cover regular reserve as well as special reserves.
Yeah, normally, capital is the difference between liabilities and assets.
Yeah.
And maybe a credit union has a special way of determining that. I don't know.
Yes, Mr. Gashi, you can go. If you could just supply us the answer to those, and they are technical questions. But as Senator Simmons mentioned, we need to be sure, and so we just appreciate you giving us that response.
Thank you.
The distinction between the two. Any further questions on Senate Bill 148? All right, we skipped over 147. Now we'll return to Senate Bill 147, and
that's the one that I moved the table.
Yes, that's the one, and we thought that we would allow Mr. Bronner to see us do it just to help his day along. Yes. Mr. Gashi, would you go, since you're there, would you go ahead and then we'll allow Mr. Bronner to respond?
Mr. Chairman, I appear in support of Senate Bill 147. And basically, the intent of this is to give us rulemaking powers to set the dates for payments of fees by the institutions that we regulate. It also provides that the action of setting the dates shall be subject to approval of the administrator. Presently, banks are assessed on April 15 of each year. Trust companies are assessed at exam time. Credit unions are assessed as of January 15. Consumer finance as of December 15. And savings and loans at end of July 31 of each year. We'd like the ability to by rule, change the payment dates and to straighten out our cash flow and also to handle other problems such as in the credit union area. January 15 is too close because we use the average assets for the last three quarters, which would be the period ending December 31 of each year, and in 15 days, a lot of the institutions have not completed their accounting for the year and still have adjustments and things to make, and we hit the bubble at that point because if their end-of-year accounts are not settled, then it's difficult to determine what the correct fees should be. And so we need the flexibility to change the dates to a more reasonable date for that purpose. And that's basically my testimony.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Gashi. Any questions concerning Senate Bill 147? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next witness will be Mr. Frank Bronner.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association and the State Chartered Banks of Oregon. We support Senate Bill 147. We believe that the department, the Financial Institutions Division, needs to have annual assessments rather than examination-based assessments. Thanks to this committee and last session and the interim work that Senator Frey engaged in, banking was moved to an April 15th assessment time, and by rule, the supervisor establishes the level of fees. Somehow, Senator Frey, my fault, we forgot to handle trust companies. They're still on an examination-based assessment, which means that when the department runs